This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Bottling everything up is never a good idea. It can have some terrible consequences. I mean, think about the subject matter we cover on our show. I wonder how much easier it would be if we normalized talking about negative feelings instead of lashing out when it all builds up. I recently had a session where I faced some things going on in my life I hadn't spoken to anyone about, and when I talked about it with my therapist, I realized how heavy it actually was, and I was able to see it in a different light, and it didn't feel as heavy anymore. When you need to talk, but you want a safe space for that conversation, I highly recommend BetterHelp. Even if you haven't experienced major trauma in your life, therapy is excellent for day-to-day positive coping skills and learning how to set boundaries. So if you want to give therapy a try, check out BetterHelp. It's entirely online, convenient, and flexible. It's also easy to get started. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/serialkillers today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/serialkillers.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Now, enjoy the show.
Yes, I was born with a devil inside of me. I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than the poet can help inspiration to song, nor the ambition of an intellectual man to be great. I was born with the evil one standing as my sponsor beside the bed where I was ushered into the world, and he has been with me ever since.
Such were some of the final recorded words of the infamous killer, Herman Webster Mudgett, or as he is more famously known, H.H. Holmes. Holmes was a careful yet vicious killer who claimed dozens of lives in Chicago in the late 1800s. He was a murderer and a con man, known most famously for the Labyrinthine Mansion where he would kill his victims. The Murder Castle, as it would later be called, was a terrifying death trap filled with soundproof rooms, asphyxiation chambers, human-sized stoves, trap doors, mazes, and laboratories. His story is intertwined with lies and secrecy, confusion and tantalizing mysteries that are left unsolved even today. News reports, police statements, and even Holmes' own confessions contradict in so many places, it's nearly impossible to tell what's fact and fiction.
I killed 27 people and another 4 attempted. Killed absolutely no one. My supposed 9 victims.
He quickly became a media sensation as the public waited with bated breath to see what would happen to the terrifying killer. To them, he was an anomaly. In fact, they didn't even have a word for Holmes in his own time. He was one of the first serial killers ever known. Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and welcome to Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of some of the most infamous and notorious murderers. This week, our subject is H.H. Holmes, often cited as America's first serial killer. If you want to listen to any episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all on your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, parcast.com, spelled P-A-R-C-A-S-T.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation. Even among serial killers, Holmes' case is not a simple one. We have no idea how many people Holmes killed. We can't even get a good ballpark estimate. He confessed to 27 murders, was confirmed to have killed 9, had the motive to kill dozens, if not hundreds, and yet was convicted of only one.
You are hereby convicted for the sole murder of...
What complicates the matter further is that Holmes gave 3 entirely different confessions, each citing different death counts and methods of killing. So we can't use him as a reliable source when piecing together his story. We also don't know exactly when Holmes started killing, but there are sources that suggest he may have committed his first murder when he was only 11 years old. Holmes was also interesting in that he was cordial and well-respected. So much so that when he was revealed to be a killer, many people refused to believe it. Which brings up an interesting question. How can you tell when someone might be a killer? What are the warning signs? Before we dive into Holmes' case, let me introduce you to Vanessa. Vanessa will be answering questions I have about the mental makeup of a serial killer. What makes them tick? What molded them and what their thought process is like? It's important to note that she's not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but like me, she's fascinated by the psychology of serial killers and has done a lot of research for the show. Hi, Vanessa. Thanks for joining us today.
Of course.
Psychologists often talk about warning signs for identifying criminals. What sort of warning signs do you typically see with serial killers? Where do you start looking?
Well, as with most violent criminals, the warning signs for serial killers are most evident in childhood, regardless of when they start their killing spree.
That's interesting. What sorts of childhoods are common for serial killers?
Well, they typically come from abusive households. Statistically, serial killers are 6 times more likely than an average member of the population to have been physically abused in childhood, and about half experience emotional and mental abuse from their guardians. In addition, about 70% of identified serial killers have come from families where one or both parents abused alcohol or other substances.
Wow, this actually sounds a lot like H.H. Holmes' childhood.
Did he also grow up isolated from others and spend most of his time alone, sneaking off to do things like torture and kill small animals?
In fact, he did. Let me guess, those are also common childhood traits for a serial killer?
Yep. In interviews conducted with convicted serial killers, the FBI found that most didn't have close friendships or family bonds in childhood, and that an even larger amount enacted their violent fantasies on animals before moving on to human victims.
This all fits right into Holmes' own story, though the details of his childhood are a lot more unsettling than statistics can convey. Holmes was born in New Hampshire in 1861. Both his parents were devout Methodists and demanded his obedience from a young age. His mother was said to be a cold and distant individual who parented primarily through religion.
You are sin. Sin incarnate. Get down on your knees and beg forgiveness.
His father, on the other hand, was a violent drunk who used physical discipline as his primary method of parenting. Some of their disciplinary tactics included prolonged isolation and food deprivation. Apparently, his father would hold kerosene-soaked rags over Holmes and his siblings' mouths when they were crying too loudly.
Wow, that's certainly a lot to stomach.
Not only was Holmes abused at home, but he was also bullied in school for not getting good grades.
Look at him!
Got his nose in the books.
Won't even stand up for himself.
What a meter!
He later recounted a story of how several of his classmates dragged him into the local doctor's office and forced him to stare into the face of a skeleton, and even put the skeleton's hands on his face.
No, get off me! Stop!
Come on! Give it a kiss.
That likely worsened his mental state.
He actually attributed the traumatic incident to his fascination with skeletons and medicine, and even cited it as the reason he went to medical school.
That seems fairly likely. A lot of people cope with traumatic experiences by embracing what traumatized them. It helps give them power over the situation.
He also went on to say that as a child and early teenager, he would sneak off to the nearby forest to escape physical abuse, where he began to experiment with animals. which I believe you already mentioned is not so unique for serial killers.
That's right.
But there was actually something more important that happened around this time. His alleged first kill. Though he spent most of his time alone, Holmes had an older friend named Tom, who he would explore the town with. One day, while they were exploring an abandoned house together... Tom fell off a landing and plummeted to his death. It can't be entirely proven, but it's generally thought that Holmes, curious what it would be like to see someone die, pushed his friend off the landing. Though there wasn't much indication that he killed anyone else when he was a kid, there were plenty of rumors, and more concrete ones at that, swirling around him in his early 20s, shortly after he graduated from medical school. In New York, 1884, Holmes was seen with a young boy, who later mysteriously vanished without explanation. Holmes claimed the boy moved to Massachusetts, but it was never verified, and Holmes quickly left town. Sometime after, he got a job at a drugstore in Philadelphia, where another young boy died after taking medicine bought from the store. Again, Holmes was accused, and again he denied it, and immediately left town. While on a surface level, one could pass it off as coincidence, the suspicion around Holmes was so strong when he made his permanent move to Chicago in 1886, he changed his name from Herman Mudgett to H.H. Holmes, the moniker he's still known by today. To me, it seems like he was afraid his past might catch up to him. What do you think, Vanessa? When someone changes their name, what does that usually indicate about their emotional state?
Well, people often change their name when they're struggling to accept who they are. Changing your name helps you form a new identity and escape the past that's been weighing you down. New name, new you. Of course, with Holmes, it may have just been a more pragmatic decision.
What about his quick relocation? Does moving so quickly after a scandal indicate guilt?
Again, relocation has a lot to do with moving on from your past. Holmes probably didn't see much potential in sticking around where his name and reputation were tarnished so badly.
Though it seems that Holmes was running away to evade rumors of him killing people, it's also possible he was running away to avoid taking responsibility for his cons. While Holmes came to fame as a vicious serial killer, he actually spent just as much of his time conning people and tricking them out of their property. He frequently took on false identities and created fake companies to pull off his scams. And in the late 1800s, where advanced and unified record keeping was not yet possible, it was fairly easy for him to get away with his cons, as long as he moved around and kept changing names.
$700 for the miracle water.
I'll pay you a full $1,000 if you can get me the property.
$200 in stolen furniture. Again,
signed land deed.
In fact, when Holmes went to build his murder castle, as it would later be known, he did it in Holmesian fashion, through cheating people out of their money. On its surface, the Chicago building was a simple business venture. It was a three-story building. On the first floor, there were shops like jewelers, clothing stores, and a pharmacy, and on the upper two levels, there were residential apartments. However, Holmes' building housed more than just stores and apartments. It was a massive structure filled with dozens of hidden rooms and utilities, including soundproof bedrooms, asphyxiation chambers, stoves that could fit people inside of them, a death shaft, laboratories, mazes, trap doors, and secret passageways, which he used as he made his mark as a serial killer. It's also around this time that he met someone who would later become known as one of the most important keys to unlocking the mystery of Holmes' murders. In November 1889, while Holmes was constructing his castle, he met a man by the name of Benjamin Peitzel. Peitzel was initially hired to work on the building, but he quickly became Holmes' all-around assistant, helping with everything from legal business ventures to less legal scams and elaborate cons. Peitzel would even, unintentionally, assist Holmes in finding murder victims.
Have I found the loveliest of ladies for you, Holmes?
But with the construction of the castle, Holmes was merely beginning his life of crime. That he had a castle designed for murder is chilling enough, But its construction process tells another intriguing tale. One of his employees later said in an interview,
Holmes's favorite method in building was to hire a gang of workmen, pay them for a while, and then let them go without their wages until they were ready to lay off. Then he would let the building lay idle. After a time, he would hire other workmen, none of whom were acquaintances of those who had worked before.
The result was that this massive Chicago castle was intelligible to but one person, Holmes himself. There were so many interconnected rooms, askew hallways, chaotic mazes, trick floors, secret passageways, and one-way doors, it made the place accessible only to someone who intimately knew its quirks. And of course, the coup de grace of the whole thing was that it was designed for the very nefarious intent of murder. Although we don't know exactly how many people he killed in these rooms, we do know that he had a curious habit of taking out insurance policies on all the staff working at the castle and making himself the benefactor. His employees, usually female ones, would often disappear or suddenly decide to move to a new state or take an extended vacation. However, Holmes' first confirmed kill wasn't until the early 1890s, about 5 years after the construction of the castle. In September 1889, Holmes hired Ned Connor to run the jewelry shop on the ground floor of the castle. He was unsettled and a little put off by Holmes, but accepted the job. Ned later said in an interview with the newspaper,
"Everything went on very nicely for a while, but after some time there was trouble between me and my first wife, Julia L. Connor. The trouble first started through jealousy on her part."
Holmes attempted to mediate the marital spat, but the more he did, the more evident it became that he had ulterior motives.
"You shouldn't let such a feeble man yell at you like that."
"You wouldn't have hired him if he was feeble."
"That's true."
"He's not feeble, but he may be weaker than I thought. I keep catching him catching the eye of another woman."
"Why would he need to look anywhere else when he has you in front of him?"
"You flatter. He's always been a bit of a spiteful man. You don't seem like that, though, Mr. Holmes. I don't know why, but I get the sense that I can trust you."
"You can, Mrs. Connor, without a doubt."
Holmes and Julia began to have an affair, despite the fact that Holmes was already married to two different women. Through the years, Holmes would develop a reputation for marrying women, boring of them, and sending them off somewhere before engaging in another tryst.
"What of your wife?"
"It's but a name only. You, my love, are what's in my heart."
"I see."
This was exactly what happened to Holmes' then-wife, Murda Belknap. Through 1890 and 1891, Holmes ignored Murda, who lived with her daughter a few towns over, instead spending an enormous amount of time with Julia, teaching her bookkeeping and helping her with her career. Though Ned initially believed his wife and Holmes' relationship to be platonic, he was soon forced to face the truth.
"He told me things about her one could only know if they'd been intimate. I wanted to believe it false, but facts are hard to deny."
At the same time, Holmes is trying to push Ned to do something rather odd. He wanted Ned to get life insurance.
"Why are you and Holmes so anxious to have me get life insurance?"
"It's for our daughter, Ned. For our Pearl. God forbid something happens to one of us. What do you expect will come of her?"
"You can do as you please, but I will never insure myself."
"Come now, Mr. Connor. It's hardly a trouble. You can get in for a dollar."
"Here, Holmes. I'll give you a dollar, and you can take one out on yourself."
"It wouldn't be any use for me."
"I'll take one. One of us has to care for our child."
"Fine. You do that."
"Don't worry, my sweet. You've made the right decision."
After several months, Ned quit his job and left Julia and his daughter Pearl behind. Holmes and Julia continued having an affair until 1891, when Julia gave Holmes some shocking news. She was pregnant. Holmes wanted nothing to do with the child and suggested Julia get an abortion.
"It's for the best, Julia. The scandal alone would be too much, not to mention the stress of another child. You think so too, don't you?"
I'm not sure what I think. I waver, but if you say there isn't another choice, there mustn't be one. I'll trust you have both our interests in mind.
Believe me, I do.
Here the accounts vary a bit. One story says that on Christmas Eve, 1891, Holmes killed Julia under the pretext of performing an abortion on her. Sometime on the same day, he also killed her 4-year-old daughter, Pearl, with an overdose of chloroform. Holmes' own account of the murder, however, says nothing about Julia's pregnancy nor an abortion. Instead, he simply says that he poisoned the two and buried their bodies in the basement of the castle. After their deaths, he told everyone that they had gone away to visit her dying sister. Like many of the others, Holmes said, had gone away. They never returned. The question here, though, is why did Holmes spend so much time wooing and helping Julia before killing her? Did he get a thrill out of it, or was he just bored of his plaything?
We are starting to see a pattern of Holmes using people like tools and disposing of them. During the construction of the castle, Holmes used the construction workers until he no longer needed them. Then he let them go without pay, essentially throwing them away.
Still, it seems like there was a different situation here with Julia. For a good portion of the time, he was helping her and teaching her. They were also intimate, unlike the construction workers, or so I would assume.
Well, killing Julia may have played into part of his fantasies. We have already started to notice a pattern of Holmes hiring young females who would disappear or meet untimely deaths. Perhaps Julia was just one of the few who got a little more time in the spotlight.
Interesting. What usually motivates someone to kill a lover?
The most common causes are revenge or jealousy. These murders are usually rage kills, a kill of blind passion, and typically not premeditated. But in Holmes' case, both murders are far too complex to not be premeditated. And the steps he took to hide Julia and Pearl's bodies afterwards suggest he already thought his plan through well.
In that case, do you think he might have fetishized killing women?
That's highly likely. We do see a lot of serial killers with whom sex and murder is deeply intertwined. Many killers have equated the high of killing to the peak of sexual pleasure. If that was the case for Holmes, then targeting an attractive female victim makes sense.
In addition to psychological or sexual satisfaction, a large part of the plan may have revolved around cashing in on the insurance policy Holmes had taken out on Julia. When Holmes was in medical school, he would pass off the cadavers used by medical students as accident victims and claim life insurance on them. To me, it looks like the killing of Julia and Pearl was a more advanced version of the con. Would you agree? What might make a criminal make the jump from a small-time crime like theft or conning to a more serious crime like murder?
There are many reasons. Desperation, if you think it's your only way to survive. Greed, if the reward outweighs your conscience. Boredom, if the criminal is psychopathic, for instance, they might move to a worse crime to bring back excitement. But these are all extreme examples. It takes a certain detachment or hatred to go through with a plan like that. Since society has conditioned us from a young age that killing is one of the worst things we can do as a human.
So then what seems more likely, was killing Julie and Pearl just a ploy to get more insurance money? Or was there a deeper emotional motivator tied up in the killings?
I don't believe the two are mutually exclusive. We've established that Holmes is very materialistic and has a particular attraction to making money. So the lure of killing to make the insurance scam run faster may have been quite appealing to him.
And that's $14,000. May she rest in peace.
Thank you.
I have a question for you now. You said Holmes was running scams all over the place. Did he really need the money that came from the insurance policies?
He did have several sources of income, thanks to both his cons and the legal profits at the store. Though the payout was high in the insurance scam, it wasn't imperative to maintaining his fortune. Why?
Well, as I mentioned before, the threshold for jumping from petty theft to first-degree murder is pretty high. Aside from desperation, it takes a lot for someone to commit to an organized murder plot. Seeing how risky the endeavor was and that he didn't desperately need money, he more likely killed because he enjoyed it.
But what about the insurance money?
It was probably just a bonus motivator.
Regardless of the motivation, Neither his cons nor kills would slow in the years following Julia and Pearl's murders. After they died, there were several more women who mysteriously vanished or died, but those deaths were never fully substantiated or concretely linked to Holmes. Though he did later confess to three of them, Anna Betts in February of 1892, Emily Van Tassel in June of 1892, and Gertrude Connor in July of 1892, all via poisoning. Anna and Gertrude both died in their homes, while Emily was allegedly buried in the basement of the castle. Her body was never found. The next confirmed kill, however, was that of Emmeline Sigrand in December of 1892. Emmeline was particularly significant in that she marked the first confirmed case of Holmes using his murder castle to actually murder someone. Our story will continue in a moment, right after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Now, our story continues.
In early 1892, Holmes noticed that his right-hand man and partner in cons, Benjamin Peitzel, was having trouble with alcoholism. Worried for his friend, he paid for Peitzel's treatment. Holmes said of Peitzel,
"He was too valuable a man for me to dispense of him, even with his failings taken into consideration."
In May 1892, Peitzel came back from the sobriety clinic, not sober, but with news of their secretary's astounding beauty. Holmes was taken in by Peitzel's description of the woman and offered her a job as a stenographer, luring her away with a boost in salary.
"And I would like to formally extend an offer of employment as secretary at the Silver Ash Institution. Salary to be evaluated at..."
Emmeline accepted the offer and came to Chicago to work at the Silver Ash Institution, Holmes' fake sobriety clinic. It's not entirely clear how it all happened, but in December of 1892, Holmes tricked Emmeline into entering a soundproof room deep inside the castle and locked her inside. He refused to release her until she wrote a wedding announcement stating she was to marry Robert Phelps, a person that Holmes likely made up.
"Mr. Holmes, let me out. I finished the letters, all right? I finished them. Holmes? Oh, thank God. I thought I would suffocate. It's so stuffy in there."
"Give me the letters."
"Here they are."
"Thank you, Mr. Grand. These will work beautifully."
"Wait, Holmes, what are you... Stop! Holmes, let me out! Let me out!"
The assistant chief of police in Chicago later spoke of the police's theory on what happened inside that locked room.
"The steel tomb was practically airtight. With the door closed, death from suffocation must ensue within a short time. The victim might struggle, scream... beat on the doors in vain, but nothing would come of her. The room was soundproof, and she was locked within. One can imagine the chill which must have swept over even Holmes himself when he came back to the vault and slowly turned the wheel of the combination. The notch clicked from 30 to 50 and back to 20, three times around. The tumblers fell in their proper places. He gave a tug at the heavy door, and it swung open. And perhaps the body of Emmeline Sigrand fell out."
Emmeline was never seen or heard from again, and her body was never found. And though Assistant Chief Ross would later be proven incorrect about his theory of Emmeline being locked in a vault, she was more likely locked in a simple, soundproof, sealed room, as the vault had not been built yet. His description of Emmeline's final struggle was probably fairly accurate. Again, Holmes lied that she had run off. He used the wedding announcements that he forced her to write as proof that she was going off with her spouse. Though some were suspicious, there was no investigation of the matter, and Holmes was free to carry on with his life without worries. While the deaths of Emmeline and Julia were most definitely creepy, the really unsettling thing about all this, though, is that while Holmes was committing these terrible acts of murder, he was known around town for being a genuinely nice person. One of his employees at the castle said,
"Holmes, in one sense and way, was kind-hearted and generous. If a stranger was in the vicinity, without money and had sickness in his family, Holmes let him have money and drugs. Though he had many wives, he cared for them all, and their children."
Another employee, E.C. Davis, who ran the jewelry shop, said something similar.
"He never gambled, smoked, or drank. He was the smoothest man I ever saw. Why, I've known creditors to come here raging and calling all names imaginable, and he would smile and talk to them and set up cigars and drinks and send them away seemingly friends for life. I never saw him angry. You couldn't have trouble with him if you tried."
It seems like there's two sides to the Holmes coin. A proverbial Jekyll and Hyde, if you will. But what might explain this kind of personality? How could he be so calm and amicable and yet kill so easily? What would you say, Vanessa?
It's a telltale sign of psychopathy. One common trait of psychopaths is that they remain emotionless in almost every situation. They're less likely to get angry, harder to provoke to emotion, and don't feel embarrassment or shame as readily. They also aren't afraid to use people as tools, which we've definitely seen with Holmes murdering people for insurance money.
That does fall in line with our next set of victims as well. Though it wasn't clear if Emmeline was part of an insurance plot or not, Holmes' next victims were likely targeted for their wealth. In 1888, Holmes met Minnie Williams, a young heiress, during a business trip in New York. They got along well and sent each other love letters over the years. Then, in 1893, when he found himself in need for a stenographer, seeing as he had just killed his last one, he hired Minnie Williams for the task.
"Dear Minnie, my love, I've found an opening for you here in Chicago. I'd love nothing more than to have you by my side. Signed, H.H. Holmes."
She agreed and moved to Chicago to work at the castle. In April of 1893, the two were married in a secret wedding. Again, Holmes was still married to two other women. But as with Julia, the affair may have only been a ruse to steal her fortune.
"Soon after entering my employ, I induced her to give me $2,500 in money and to transfer to me by deed $50,000 worth of Southern real estate. I also learned that she had a sister in Texas who was an heir to some property."
Holmes induced Minnie to invite her sister to the castle, and Minnie did so. Anna Williams arrived in Chicago mid-1893, unaware of her coming fate.
"It was an easy matter to force her to assign to me all she possessed. After that, she was immediately killed in order that no one in or about the castle should know of her having been there."
We'll return to our story in just a moment from the Parcast Network. And now, back to our story.
Around July 5th, 1893, Holmes locked Anna in the vault in the castle, where he asphyxiated her by flooding the room with gas via a tube connected to the gas tank. All that remained of her struggle was a single footprint on the inside of the vault door, one which later provided evidence in connecting her death with Holmes. Minnie, however, stayed with Holmes a while longer. In fact, there was some speculation that Minnie and Holmes engaged in more than a secret romance, that she was actually one of Holmes' partners in crime. One of the employees at the castle noted,
"She was as deep in his schemes as he was. He thought a great deal of her, and she knew business thoroughly, and was a very cunning girl."
In between killing people, Holmes was running con after con, earning more money with which he used to expand his murder castle. Minnie even took on fake names and headed shell companies that Holmes created to enact his schemes.
"That's the third payout this week. We'll be richer than the Queen of England at this rate."
"You've done well, Minnie dear. I couldn't have done it without you."
And though you'd think he would be just as quiet about his cons as he would his murders, it was actually fairly well known that he was already engaged in some sort of money-making scheme. One resident in the castle said of him,
I never saw such a man. Everything he touched turned to money, and no matter what he did, he escaped punishment. He swindled hundreds of merchants, and then laughed at them.
And another newspaper wrote,
H.H. Holmes has been one of the best patrons furniture dealers have had for years. He purchased large bills, and he did not haggle about the prices. In fact, Mr. Holmes was an ideal customer but for one thing. He neglected to pay for the goods.
In fact, many of the secret rooms in his castle were also used to hide stolen goods. The vault, for instance, once housed dozens of pieces of furniture that he never paid for. He also had the habit of purchasing goods on credit and then immediately selling them to someone else. He did this for cash registers, furniture, bicycle, lumber, and many other products around town. He once even obtained a safe on credit and installed it in brick in his house, so it would be impossible to move it without destroying it. Naturally, the safe was never removed, and he never paid for it. But my burning question is, if he was so well known for playing everyone, why would people keep coming back to him? What do you think, Vanessa?
Well, based on what his employees said about him, he was a very persuasive person. This skill was also likely what allowed him to easily lure employees into his hidden rooms and kill them without notice.
Do you think he treated his normal money-making scams the same as those involving murder? Was he, as scary as it sounds, simply a psychopath who saw no difference between killing for money and stealing a bunch of lumber?
It is possible. If Holmes had no emotional attachment to other humans, there would be no reason for him to hesitate when he saw a good scam.
That might also explain what happened with Minnie Williams. Well, Minnie stayed with Holmes for about a year, helping with scams and possibly, as sometimes suggested, with his kills, her time with him would soon come to an abrupt end. After using Minnie to pull off insurance scams, run cons, and even lure her sister to an early grave, Holmes tossed her aside just as quickly as he picked her up.
I took Minnie 8 miles east of Moments, Illinois, upon a freight line that is little used. It ended her life with poison. I buried her body in the basement of the house.
Up until now, the only concrete murders attributed to Holmes were young females, several of whom he had relationships with. Why do you think that might be?
Based on what you told me about Holmes' childhood, I believe it might have something to do with being in power. With his wealth and connections, he could easily give them whatever they wanted, jobs, money, even romance, and then just as easily take it away. As someone who grew up with no power, being able to flip the tables probably felt good.
But why females specifically?
If he really was as attractive and charming as the stories make him out to be, it would have been easier to lure in straight female victims and gain their trust.
I still have a tough time understanding how he could kill all these women after having relationships with them.
Well, if you want to look back at his childhood again, when a child is neglected or abused, it can stunt their development process. They may become desensitized to violence or form a numbness when it comes to emotions as a means of protecting themselves. They may also come to see violence as normal and become incapable of empathizing with other people.
So his childhood abuse really did cause him to become a killer?
Yes and no. One thing to keep in mind is that while serial killers are often victims of physical and mental abuse, there are plenty of abuse victims who are not killers. Saying abuse causes someone to be a killer is over-presumptuous. Rather, abuse more likely pushes those who already had the propensity for violence towards acting on it.
Holmes' violence was definitely growing as the body count started piling up. And like most criminals, his crimes would soon catch up with him. In July of 1894, he was finally caught for selling mortgaged goods. He was locked up in jail, and almost as soon as he was bailed out. In fact, Holmes treated the entire thing with levity, barely batting an eye at the charge. What he didn't know, however, was that that brief stint in jail would completely alter the course of his life. While locked up, Holmes struck up a conversation with a convicted train robber by the name of Marion Hedgepeth. While the conversation was seemingly normal for a pair of criminals, it would become far more important than Holmes ever intended.
So, you were a train robber, eh?
The best at my job.
That's why you're here, I suppose.
I said I was good at stealing. Didn't say anything about being good at not getting caught for it.
You know, you strike me as someone who would like to have some extra coins clinking around in your pocket.
I prefer the sound of crisp bills, actually.
Well, I've got a foolproof way to make some of those slick bills. 10,000 of them, to be exact. You seem like a man who knows his way around the darker streets. All I need is the name of a lawyer you trust.
And what's my commission?
500 of those bills you like.
You know, I could do with a little more. I'm accustomed to big payouts, you see.
Ah, well, then I suppose I'll ask someone else. Say, are any of you gentlemen interested in making a quick buck?
No. You hold on. I have a name. Jephthah Howe. That's the man you want.
Thank you. And would you look at that? I'm already about to check out of this place. Oh, and Mr. Hedgepeth, don't be so surprised if you see a concerning obituary floating around the pages. You'll have your crisp 500, I guarantee it.
Don't worry, I don't much care for the papers anyhow.
The plan Holmes had concocted was very similar to his other insurance scams. Fake a death, then take the insurance money. This time, however, he was going to outdo all that came before it. He was going to fake his own death. After making bail, Holmes trekked to St. Louis, where he met with Marion Hedgepeth's dirty lawyer, Jephthah Howe. Jephthah thought the scheme was brilliant and eagerly jumped aboard.
I can practically see the money rolling in. You're a brilliant man, Holmes.
He carefully planned out each stage, picking out an appropriate corpse and setting the scene to look like an accident. But when he went to collect the insurance money, he was denied. The insurance company was suspicious of the death and refused to pay out.
I'm sorry, sir, but the company has marked your inquiry as suspicious. You can press the claim using the form.
Holmes, though annoyed, didn't press the claim. Instead, he took his plan to his right-hand man, Benjamin Peitzel, the same man that informed him of Emmeline Segrand's beauty, but months before Holmes killed her. For much of 1893, just before Holmes was arrested, Holmes and Peitzel traveled around Texas and Philadelphia together, pulling off various scams. But in September of 1894, Peitzel was to be in on a scam that would make him far more famous than he ever expected.
Holmes, what are you doing here?
I've made a plan, Peitzel.
Another one of those?
Don't make out like you don't want a part in it. You want to hear it, don't you?
Should I fetch my coat?
No, no. Let me come in. Mrs. Peitzel ought to hear this one, too.
Carrie?
I've met a man by the name of Jephthah Howe. We've concocted a foolproof plan to make a lump sum, and we'll split it between the three of us.
What's my wife got to do with this?
Why, she's incredibly important. She'll be playing the part of the mourning widow.
The plan was foolproof. Peitzel would go to Philadelphia, where he would establish himself as an inventor under the name of B.F. Perry. The two would then stage an explosion in the lab and switch Peitzel out with a cadaver that Holmes procured. Mrs. Peitzel would then go to identify her poor fake husband and collect the insurance payout. Peitzel was easily lured in, perhaps out of loyalty to his friend and perhaps out of the temptation of splitting $10,000. Keep in mind, an average weekly salary in this time might be around $12, so $10,000 was quite a bit of cash. They worked out the details of the plot, and then on September 2nd, 1894, they went through with the plan.
Welcome. Oh, Mr. Holmes. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Perry. We're all rearing to go. Your wife misses you truly. She's been aching to carry out the plan earlier and earlier.
Oh, she just wants that money. You got the cadaver all picked out? How much does it look like me?
Oh, it could be you in the flesh.
How did you pull off such a feat? What a question. You're H.H. Holmes. What other reason do I need? Well, let's get it in here.
Now, set down your tools. It'll take both of us to pull it in.
All right.
And then, as Peitzel turned away, Holmes knocked his partner out, binding his hands and feet with rope. That day, instead of mutilating a dead body to claim insurance, H.H. Holmes killed his friend by burning him alive with benzene. Benjamin Peitzel, supposedly Holmes' closest companion, became just another victim of the treacherous killer. Well, what would cause Holmes to turn on his right-hand man and partner in crime? And why, after killing all those young women, did he suddenly change his pattern? What exactly was going through his mind as he killed Benjamin Peitzel? Find out next week as we delve further into the mind of the notorious serial killer and learn the conclusion of this twisted tale. Thank you for listening to Serial Killers. Be sure to join us next Monday as we conclude our look into the mind of H.H. Holmes. If you enjoyed this episode, please tell your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory. Or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's P-A-R-C-A-S-T Network. Have a killer week. Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admeyer. Serial Killers is written by Jen Enfield Kane and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Jerry Courtney Austin, Mike Capozzi, Al Falick, Manu Narayan, and Stephen Pinto.